B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. Just returning after a somewhat lengthy Labor Day break. We drove the smoky skies of California to the Los Angeles area, where the air was clear over the weekend, but new wildfires are probably changing that. We'll update you on the fires burning in California and other western states as the podcast rolls on today. But our top story comes from London, where we saw today day two of the hearings related to extradition to the United States of WikiLeaks founder and operator Julian Assange. And as you know, I think that this is a very serious issue of press freedom. To see the United States trying to prosecute a non-citizen using the extradition laws from Britain to bring Assange to the United States to face the draconian Espionage Act, it's all sordid. And the kangaroos don't deserve having this court process named after them. So I'm going to give you a quick roundup here based on coverage first from Kevin Gostola. He, of course, is the co-founder of Shadowproof, and he has managed to get online access to the trial, which has not been easy. And he's getting up in the middle of the night to monitor the proceedings in London from his base in Chicago. We also have other coverage that I will share with you shortly. So you may know the judge in the case has really exposed her bias in the preliminary hearings, and that exposure continues in the first 2 days. They don't have Labor Day in England, as you know, and so the initial proceedings were yesterday. That was day one. So what we saw were some skirmishes between the defense attorneys representing Assange, the American representative, and the British lawyers hired by the United States. So it's a little bit of a complicated proceeding. And one of the issues is related to the submission, or the substitution, if you will, of a revised indictment, a superseding indictment. And this occurred during the month of July, and the lawyers for Assange have tried to win a delay. And it's a little complicated because they initially turned down an offer by the judge for adjournment because they didn't want to leave Assange in prison any longer than necessary. But given that they only officially have had a few weeks to evaluate the expanded indictment from the United States, the lawyers did make an effort first to get the new superseding indictment severed from the original indictment. And actually, that was the second. It gets complicated. The new superseding is the third indictment. And so that was unsuccessful. And the first of what we expect to be many rulings from the bench of Judge Berazer was read from her computer, a laptop that she brought into the courtroom, which indicates that she is delivering prefabricated rulings from the bench. It's almost as if the lawyers in the courtroom can say anything they want, and she'll bang the gavel and say, "Okay, no matter what you said, here is my decision." So that was pretty much what happened on day one. They did begin testimony from an American journalism professor, and we'll get to that in a moment. I'm turning now to the account of Craig Murray. He is a close associate of Assange. He has admitted that he carried a storage device from the United States to Britain that included some hacked materials, presumably copied from the Democratic National Committee's servers. That was in the summer of 2016. And I have linked to his report, which is rich in detail. He tells us about the trial scene in the Old Bailey, which has been a forum for justice, or the lack of it, since, at least 500 years ago. Hundreds of thousands of trials have taken place there. There is a revised cage for Julian Assange. The dock in which he is held still has a bulletproof glass screen in front, like it did at the Belmarsh prison hearings, but it was not boxed in. There's no top to the screen, no low ceiling, so sound could flow freely over, and Julian seemed much more in the court. It also had more and wider slits compared to the glass box they had before, and Julian was able to communicate quite readily. As we'll get to, he did make a comment in court that drew the ire of the judge and a threat that she would have him removed. And it's a very limited crowd in the courtroom for social distancing reasons, but also it's pretty clear that they want to try to keep the coverage to a minimum and also try to compress the proceedings. And one of the issues that Murray describes is how the judge first said, well, you know, I've seen all the written statements from the defense witnesses, so don't repeat all that stuff in the courtroom. And it is not a jury trial, so that is a distinction. But still, to dispense with the groundwork, the legal groundwork that an attorney makes when you introduce a witness, and to go directly to cross-examination, that is truly bizarre. She also said in the early goings of the proceedings on Monday that she would only agree to remote access where it is in the interests of justice, and she decided that for the most part it's not. She said the public could normally observe from within the courtroom where she could control their behavior, but if they had remote access, she couldn't control their behavior. So, who fucking cares? And Murray has a humorous moment here. He says, Braetzer did not expand on what uncontrolled behavior she anticipated from those viewing via the Internet. It's certainly true that an observer from Amnesty sitting at home might be in their underwear, might be humming the complete soundtrack to Mamma Mia, or might fart loudly. Precisely why this would damage the interests of justice, we are still left to ponder. But on the management of the proceedings, she basically said that a witness cannot have an hour and a half. How about 30 minutes? Now, that is arbitrary because each witness is different. Some may be speaking to a specific individual point. Others might be commenting on a whole range of issues. And so this is just another example of how this is not an ordinary or transparent proceeding. And I'll let you read the parts about the superseding indictments and the squabbling over that. It does get a little bit complicated. But fundamentally, it is a game that the U.S. played. By expanding the charges to include the hacking of a bank in Iceland and the purported theft of money from that bank and from the government of Iceland, and how that has any bearing on a U.S. prosecution of Julian Assange is well beyond me. Yet at the same time, we find that Clive Stafford Smith, who is a dual British U.S. citizen, an attorney who practices and defends people at Guantanamo, when he raised issues that the WikiLeaks revelations of the Guantanamo files were helpful to him in his defense, the British lawyers and the one representing the U.S. said, well, that's not relevant. So relevance is a weapon that's used against the defense, but not available to them. So there's also the testimony of the first witness, Professor Mark Feldstein. And for that, we turn to Consortium News, which has an account of the trial proceedings, which is unsigned, meaning I don't know the reporter who is responsible for this dispatch. But it's interesting because one of the attorneys for the Brits, a guy named Lewis, cross-examined the American professor Feldstein. And Consortium News writes, on cross-examination, Feldstein fell apart. He allowed himself to be bullied by Lewis. If this were a prize fight, the referee would have ended it. Instead, Lewis took advantage of his prey, asking legal questions he knew Feldstein was not equipped to handle. He badgered him about why the grand jury on Assange continued, even though Feldstein testified that the Obama administration decided not to prosecute because it would run up against the First Amendment. Lewis then bored into a completely flustered Feldstein about how he could call the Assange prosecution political when he couldn't prove an order came from the White House. But attorneys general and CIA directors can exert political pressure. So I don't know how much damage was done, but certainly it seemed like they filleted Professor Feldstein on the cross-examination. So the here's another section of the report on redirect. Mark Summers, the attorney for the defense, asked Smith if he was familiar with the role that Luke Harding and his co-author played when they published their book, which was called WikiLeaks Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. And as you may recall, in their book, they published the password to the entire archive of Afghan documents that contained the unredacted names of informants. And the release of those names, which the U.S. says put those people at risk, even though I don't believe there's any evidence that any of them were harmed, it was actually enabled when Harding and Lee published the password to that archive in their book. And shouldn't they be co-defendants or co-conspirators? It's just another bizarre angle of the case. So that's not a complete summary. I just want to be clear about that. But I'm not able to, as a one-man podcaster here, to give you the depth since I don't have the time to cover it myself. And I will continue to monitor the coverage by Craig Murray, by Kevin Gostola, and also from other sources, and share it with you on a daily basis. But I will expect you to follow the links and get some of the details in that manner. So I mentioned that Assange did speak up in the courtroom uninvited. And this was when Clive Stafford Smith was on the witness stand. And he said that leaks had revealed that the U.S. allegations against clients in Guantanamo, which he was then able to prove, were nonsense. And Lewis, cross-examining him, said that Assange wasn't being prosecuted in the U.S. for publishing cables. And he said Assange is not being prosecuted for publishing those cables or anything other than the documents which contain the names of informants which put their lives at risk. And apparently at that point, Julian Assange himself uttered the word nonsense. And so as a result, the judge called a quick recess, came back, and admonished Assange, saying that if it happens again, that she will continue the proceedings without him, claiming that she doesn't really want to do that. We shall see. John Pilger is a longtime journalist, and he issued a statement before he left the trial because he was sent to another courtroom where he could not actually hear the proceedings. But outside the Old Bailey, he issued a statement, quoting in part, "In 2008, a top-secret U.S. State Department report described in detail how the United States would combat this new moral threat. A secretly directed personal smear campaign against Julian Assange would lead to exposure and criminal prosecution. The aim was to silence and criminalize WikiLeaks and its founder. Page after page revealed a coming war on a single human being and on the very principle of freedom of speech and freedom of thought and democracy." And that is what happened. I have been a reporter for more than 50 years. I have never known a smear campaign like it. The fabricated character assassination of a man who refused to join the club, who believed journalism was a service to the public, never to those above. Assange shamed his persecutors, Pilger continues. He produced scoop after scoop. He exposed the fraudulence of wars promoted by the media and the homicidal nature of America's wars, the corruption of dictators, the evils of Guantanamo. He forced us in the West to look in the mirror. He exposed the official truth-tellers in the media as collaborators, those I would call Vichy journalists. None of these imposters believed Assange when he warned that his life was in danger, that the sex scandal in Sweden was a setup, and an American hellhole was the ultimate destination. He was right, and repeatedly right. The extradition hearing in London this week is the final act of an Anglo-American campaign to bury Julian Assange. It is not due process. It is due revenge. The American indictment is clearly rigged, a demonstrable sham. So far, the hearings have been reminiscent of their Stalinist equivalents during the Cold War. Freedom of the press now rests with the honorable few, the exceptions, the dissidents on the Internet who belong to no club, who are neither rich nor laden with Pulitzers, but produce fine, disobedient, moral journalism, those like Julian Assange. And he closes, "It is our responsibility to stand by a true journalist whose sheer courage ought to be inspiration to all of us who still believe that freedom is possible. I salute him," says John Pilger. And from behind bars in Pennsylvania, an American political prisoner offered this statement, Mumia Abu-Jamal. He cited the history of Julian Assange as a citizen of Australia. As such, he said, he's a journalist. His group has been a blockbuster, capturing and passing on files and internal memos of governments all around the world. For this, he has been hounded, targeted, and jailed, now serving over 50 weeks for allegedly jumping bail in Britain to avoid extradition to the U.S., which seeks to imprison him for violating the Espionage Act. Assange, born into a British Commonwealth state, is not an American and owes it no fealty. But the U.S. empire rules the world, not just U.S. territory. And when you attack the empire strikes back. For publishing documents that embarrass the United States, Assange, if convicted, faces over a century, in fact, 175 years in prison. And as a foreign national, the First Amendment to the Constitution does not provide a defense. So wait. The U.S. can invoke its criminal law for use worldwide, but the Bill of Rights doesn't obtain to foreigners? That sounds fair, writes Mumia mockingly. Later, he says, Assange, through his journalistic revelations, helped awaken generations to the elements of imperial wars. He wasn't spying. Spies work for governments and militaries. Journalists work to inform people, to broaden the reaches of democracy. The targeting of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg comes to mind. They were called spies and subsequently electrocuted. The cases of Sacco and Vanzetti, immigrants from Italy, come to mind. The targeting of the New York branch of the Black Panther Party and the trial of the Panther 21 on trumped-up charges also comes to memory. Julian Assange is a prisoner of a political vendetta. Is he thus a political prisoner? You damn betcha. That's Mumia Abu-Jamal, courtesy of his writing partner, Stephen Vittoria. Well, now to the wildfires in the West. We've been offering you some coverage of what we've been facing here in Northern California. It's been 3 weeks since the lightning strikes lit hundreds of fires. And the better news, I can't say we have total good news, but most of those fires are now considered contained. And when we drove to Los Angeles and back over the long weekend, I noticed quite a few fire trucks that were headed south, returning from the mutual aid that they provided to us in Northern California. But now we have new fires, including the Creek Fire, which is burning in the Sierra Nevada National Forest. It's grown to almost 144,000 acres, 0% contained. Earlier, during this past weekend, roughly 200 people were rescued, many by helicopter, from the Mammoth Pool Reservoir area. That's roughly in the Fresno zone of California. And then there is this maddening fire that was started at a gender reveal party. Now, I understand this is something that is special for people these days. When a couple gets pregnant, they keep the ultrasound secret, and then they throw a party for family and friends. But they used pyrotechnics out in the middle of a forest. And it has started a major fire that remains uncontained at this point. But California isn't the only zone. In Washington State, officials said that 80% of homes and structures in a town of 200 called Malden in the eastern part of the state have been destroyed by fire. In Colorado, fiery conditions and 100-degree weather have ravaged parts of the state, and now a cold front has brought a snowfall to Denver here on Tuesday morning. And we can hope that that is going to help put out the fire in the Rocky Mountains. And then we have Oregon, where a fire in the Willamette Valley, one of my favorite places for Pinot Noir wines, has started burning. And we also have a separate fire in Oregon City. And there are two others, the Beachy Creek and Lion's Head fires in eastern Marion County. So the entire West is at risk. And I hope I get to finish the podcast here, because the rogue utility Pacific Gas and Electric is busy cutting off service preemptively to customers today, because we are now under a red flag warning. The heat has eased, at least for the moment, but high winds are expected to blow through this area through tonight and into Wednesday. And PG&E is describing this as the largest safety power shutoff of the year. And last year, we had a major one in October that left us in the dark for almost a week. So it's dangerous out there. Now we look at a roundup of the protest activity, starting in Portland, where Sunday and early Monday, the scene outside the Portland Police Bureau's North Precinct was described as mostly peaceful. More than 100 people had marched, and the night before, the police had arrested 59 people, the most from a single event, in the 103 nights of protest in Portland. On Saturday night, they did declare a riot, but Sunday they said that police were thanking people for their cooperation. Seattle crossed the 100-day mark since protests began against racial injustice and police violence. About 200 people marched to the offices of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. This was on Monday. Police descended on the crowd. Scuffles broke out. 22 people were arrested there. And the police laid out what they said was evidence, including three unbroken beer bottles containing fluid and bandanas. They claim that a Molotov cocktail was thrown, ignited, and started a fire. 22 people arrested in Seattle on suspicion of assault, arson, obstructing, and failure to disperse. And this is my first opportunity to report on the case of Daniel Prude, who died after being taken into police custody in Rochester, New York, earlier this year. And it's very clear that Daniel Prude was a man with serious mental illness. His brother thought that he might be on PCP. He was out almost buck naked, sitting in the street in the middle of the night, around 3 a.m., when officers arrived at the scene. And because they felt that he was hard to restrain, they managed to get handcuffs on him, but they also put a hood over his head, they said, to prevent him from spitting on them. And so this is a messy case. The mayor of Rochester, Lovely Warren, has suspended the officers involved in the case and suggested that she was misled by the police chief, LaRon Singletary. So I'm sure this one will get more attention. On Labor Day, Monday, naked protesters honored Daniel Prude by showing up at the police headquarters. Photos and video showed a half dozen demonstrators naked or in minimal clothes, and some with Black Lives Matter written on their backs, and some were wearing hoods in the manner that Daniel Prude was. In a short-term basis, subject to asphyxiation by the cops, and it was complications from that and whatever else was going on in his body and mind that led to his death a couple of days later. Well, Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, wants to know he is alive and that he considers life precious. He gave a comment to a volunteer videographer. Your life, and not just only your life, your legs, something you need to move around and move forward in life, could be taken from you like this, man, he said, snapping his fingers in emphasis. He said it's very painful. Every 24 hours it's pain. It's nothing but pain, Blake says. It hurts to breathe. It hurts to sleep. It hurts to move from side to side. It hurts to eat. And on Friday, via video conference, he was entered a plea of not guilty to 3 domestic violence charges placed against him, including 1 count of sexual assault. On the day when he was shot, the woman who reported that assault had called 911, saying that Blake was at her home, and that's when the incident began, and Blake was initially subject to taser rounds by officers before he tried to get into the minivan and drive away with his 3 kids. And another painful incident. This one does not appear to be race-based, but just bad police behavior. A 13-year-old boy with autism was shot several times by officers who responded to his home in Salt Lake City. His mother called the cops, asking for a crisis intervention team because her son, who has Asperger's, was having an episode. Mom was trying to go back to work, and he was experiencing severe separation anxiety. And she told the cops, he's unarmed. He doesn't have anything. He just gets mad and starts yelling and screaming. He's a kid. He's trying to get attention. He doesn't know how to regulate. They're supposed to come out and be able to de-escalate a situation using the most minimal force possible. Instead, she said, 2 officers went through the front door of the home and in less than 5 minutes were yelling, get down on the ground, before firing several shots. Now, this account is the only one I have of this incident, but it just speaks to the reflexive use of gunfire. And it's hard to understand how when you're called to intervene with an out-of-control child, that you would reach for your pistol, that that's the way to subdue a young boy who is in that kind of a personal crisis. It's inexcusable. That's the best I can come up with. So the other protest report is coming from the armed vigilante types who support Donald Trump. And they are creating violent scenes that extend some of the myth-making that the Trump campaign is using to try to claim that Trump's law and order mantra is the only way to get the streets of America back under control. But over the weekend, a group of Trump supporters, as usual, they're packing their guns. They caravaned around Portland And then some of them peeled off to stage a Trump rally or to join a Trump rally at the Oregon State Capitol in Salem. And I think it's an hour, maybe less, from Salem to Portland. The Cruz rally in support of Trump began in the parking lot of a community college in Oregon City on Monday morning. Several hundred people gathered, many dressed in red, white, and blue, wearing MAGA caps, carrying signs with Trump's likeness on them. So this was an organized event put together by Oregon for Trump 2020. And I believe that they were seeking confrontation and trying to create video footage to show armed white men trying to put down the so-called violence and chaos and rioting of Black Lives Matter protests. And I don't have it in front of me, but over the weekend I read a report from an academic showing that 93% of the protests since George Floyd died have been nonviolent. There's no doubt that there has been some violence. The looting is, you know, something we all witnessed on TV. But the vast majority of these protests have been Gandhi-esque in their nonviolence. But that doesn't matter. You don't even have to give the Trumpers an inch. A millimeter will do, and they just make up the rest. So there were more than 100 people attending the rally in Salem, including some members of the Proud Boys, while a small group of counter-protesters supporting Black Lives Matter stood nearby. Some in the right-wing group carried guns, baseball bats, sticks, and pipes. The Salem Police Department, supported by state troopers, made multiple arrests after rallygoers attacked some of the counter-protesters. Videos showed that right-wing protesters were chasing, tackling, and assaulting the left-wing protesters with weapons, fists, and pepper spray. Paintballs were also fired between the two groups. One man from Durango, Colorado, 53-year-old Ty Parker, was arrested on suspicion of misdemeanor assault and first-degree intimidation. And a local man from Eugene, Trenton, Wolfskill, was also arrested, and both of those men were released. But the wackiest scene was at Lake Travis in Austin, Texas, where a flotilla of Trump supporters with their boats all festooned with MAGA signs and slogans like Trump 2020, the sequel, Make Liberals Cry Again. But several of those boats got swamped because the larger boats were just making big wakes, which caused some of the smaller boats to fill up with water and sink. And I saw this one picture of a 30-foot motorboat. And this could have been photoshopped. I have to be fair about that. But it was at the bottom of the lake, just sitting there in all of its Trump bling and branded signage. So the police authorities couldn't tell us exactly how many boats were there or exactly how many got swamped or sunk. They said there was no loss of life. And in my own experience, when there are boating accidents, it's a combination of idiots and booze. And related to Texas, we just don't know how much booze was involved. And these images, according to today's Washington Post, like what we just described in Salem, Oregon, these are now being used in the latest Trump TV commercials. Trump, of course, tweets them out. Over the weekend, he tweeted video of a melee in Texas between protesters and security officers. He had two videos of a protester in Portland with his feet on fire, and one was scored to the Kenny Loggins song, Footloose. And so the Trump campaign is trying to depict all Democrats, including Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, as supporters of anarchy. And I guess the low-information Trump voter who only gets his or her info from Rush Limbaugh or from Trump's tweets or Fox News or One America News, that they believe this stuff. And they do not seek to put it in any context because that would take all the fun out of it for them. Now, speaking of TV ads, there have been consistent reports over the past week that the Trump campaign has gone dark in key states like Arizona, where they haven't been on television since before the online convention. And the reports indicate that they had $1.1 billion that had been raised through the month of July, but they've already burned through more than $800 million of that $1.1 billion. Now, it is a a campaign where all kinds of family members are on the payroll. Before Brad Parscale got shoved aside, he was raising a lot of he was spending a lot of money trying to raise more money online. And they brought in a new guy whose name is Stepien. And Stepien has Bill Stepien is his name. He took over as campaign manager, and he deflects the questions about how much money they have burned through by saying, well, if money was the only factor determining winners and losers in politics, Jeb Bush would have been in the nominee in 2016, and we'd have the second President Clinton in the Oval Office right now. And Trump has said that if he has to, he'll chip in some of his own money. He claimed to have spent $50 million of his own in the primaries in 2016. Now, when I heard about this while I was largely unplugged from my news machinery, I was shocked that even Trump would be so stupid. He went to North Carolina, where he urged his voters to test the integrity of the mail-in balloting system by submitting an absentee ballot and then going to the polls on Election Day and asking for a ballot there. And if they're told, hey, we've got you on our list, you've already voted, then Trump would believe that the system is working. The only problem is that voting twice is a felony. And encouraging people to vote twice or other violations of election law is also a federal and a state felony in North Carolina. So elections officials hinted that the president himself could have committed a crime, stating that attempting to vote twice in an election or soliciting someone to do so is a violation of North Carolina law. Now, as I have reminded you, North Carolina is the scene of the crime of organized Republican election fraud in 2018, where they illegally harvested absentee ballots. And that is the model for the criminal behavior that Trump fears so much is going to allow Democrats to steal this election. And meanwhile, next door in Georgia, Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, he is no friend of voting rights or voting transparency allies. But he held a news conference this morning to announce that investigations are underway in 100 of the state's 159 counties following the discovery of 1,000 instances of double voting in the state's June primary and August runoff elections. Now, we got to be wary here, because the previous Secretary of State in Georgia, Brian Kemp, purged voters, refused to follow through on registering voters for Stacey Abrams that had been legally collected, the forms had. And so Raffensperger may only find Democrats who double voted, and he may be using the discredited cross-check list created by Chris Kobach of Kansas. And over the weekend, we learned that the current Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, big Trump donor, fundraiser for Mitch McConnell, he's being investigated for two forms of election campaign contribution violations. The first is that before he left the company that he sold, a trucking company in North Carolina, he got many of his employees to donate to Republican campaigns. The company was called, or is called, New Breed Logistics. And after his employees donated to Republican candidates, he gave them big bonuses or increased their bonuses. Now, this kind of reimbursement of a campaign contribution is flatly illegal. And on top of that, when DeJoy visited Capitol Hill last month, he was quizzed by Congressman Jim Cooper, a Democrat of Tennessee, who explicitly asked him if he had repaid executives for making donations to the Trump campaign. And DeJoy responded angrily, "That's an outrageous claim, sir, and I resent it. The answer is no." Well, he's got himself in a pickle there. And there are calls for him to resign or for the Board of Governors of the U.S. Postal Service to sack him. I don't think that either will happen before the election, but we shall see. Now, the other issue that really festered over the last few days is whether, in fact, the report by Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic is accurate. Did Trump, when he went to France to the memorial for soldiers who died in World War II, did he call them losers and suckers? Well, first of all, we look at the White House denials. And they are loud, not quite as loud as Kimberly Guilfoyle's speech at the Republican convention. But they're also carefully crafted. And it's clear that General John Kelly is most likely one of the unnamed four sources for the story in The Atlantic. And I have to say that this appeals to my bias. Trump calls a lot of people losers, and over the last couple of days, he has renewed his attacks on the late John McCain, who was not a hero to me, because he was a major warmonger. But it is distasteful and sick to see Trump be so obsessed with McCain. And he has alternately echoed the comments he made a few years ago that McCain was a loser because he ended up as a POW in North Vietnam, and denying that he ever said such a thing. And the Washington Post has two articles about this today, one by Philip Bump, who notes that in his follow-up comments denying that he called dead soldiers suckers and losers, Trump said this: "It's one of the reasons the military, I'm not saying the military is in love with me, the soldiers are, the top people in the Pentagon probably aren't, because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy." Now, this is so disingenuous, because Trump has bragged about how he kept selling arms to Saudi Arabia even after the assassination of Khashoggi, and that's our final story today coming up. He's also bragged about expanding the footprint of the military contractors. He hired Mark Esper to be Secretary of Defense from Raytheon. And so for him to claim that, you know, he doesn't support the way the Pentagon squanders our money is just bizarre. But he's pretty good at bizarre. Now, for a different take on this, we turn to Glenn Greenwald, publishing at The Intercept today. And he opens by citing an old case where CNN falsely reported a claim, even though they said they had independently confirmed it, This related to whether Don Trump Jr. had received an early tip-off that WikiLeaks was going to release information during the 2016 campaign. And CNN got the date wrong, and they did quietly correct it, but certainly not with the volume that they used with the original story. So Greenwald goes on to say, it seems the same misleading tactic is now driving the supremely dumb but all-consuming news cycle centered on whether Trump, as first reported by The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg, made disparaging comments about the troops. Goldberg claims that four people with firsthand knowledge of the discussion that day, whom the magazine refuses to name because they fear angry tweets, told him that Trump made these comments. Trump and others have denied it. So we have anonymous sources making claims on one side, and Trump and former aides, including John Bolton, insisting that the story is inaccurate. Beyond deciding whether or not to believe Goldberg's story based on what best advances one's political interest, how can one resolve the factual dispute? If other media outlets could confirm the original claims by Goldberg, it would obviously be a significant advancement of the story. Greenwald continues, other media outlets, including Associated Press and Fox News, now claim that they did exactly that. They confirmed the Atlantic story. But if you look at what they actually did, at what this confirmation consists of, it is the opposite of what that word would mean. And so basically, they do not attempt to confirm the actual comments attributed to Trump. They create a context of other situations where Trump lied, and they basically say, well, he lied then, so he must be lying now. And while I don't really want to defend Trump in any way, and I think he probably said these things, I think that Greenwald is accurate to challenge it, to remain skeptical, and we will see where the story goes. Here's today's COVID-19 update prepared by Linda Lewis. When we look at the statistics, currently worldwide 27.4 million cases of coronavirus have been confirmed. Total deaths attributed to the virus coming up on 900,000. In the United States, 6.3 million cases, total deaths attributed to COVID, 189,000. Just 500 away from 190. U.S. deaths will reach an estimated 410,000 by the end of the year, based on a forecast from the University of Washington's Health Institute. Deaths could be reduced by 30% if more Americans wore face masks, as epidemiologists have advised, but mask wearing is declining. The U.S. death rate projected by the model there would more than triple the current death rate, which averages about 850 per day. Quote, we expect the daily death rate in the United States because of seasonality and declining vigilance of the public to reach nearly 3,000 a day in December. In a report from CBS News, an estimate that 400,000 people were exposed to toxins at Ground Zero following 9/11, and not just first responders. Thousands breathed in air contaminated with pulverized building materials, microscopic shards of glass, and asbestos for months. More than 68 cancers are on the list of 9/11-related illnesses identified by the federal government. And now we have a wave of deaths attributed to the coronavirus of people who were there after 9/11 at the World Trade Center. An attorney, Michael Barish, whose law firm represents thousands of 9/11 survivors, responders, and victims' kin, enrolled with the Victims' Compensation Fund, says that 98 of his clients who recently died either contracted or are suspected of having gotten COVID-19 and that killed them. The 9/11 community, which already suffered enough by having been exposed to all these toxins which caused all these illnesses, they are now dying at a much greater rate than the general population. And that's a quote from Barash in the Miami Herald. And federal officials, according to ProPublica, in Washington and New York, back after 9/11, downplayed the concerns about health risks, misrepresenting or concealing information that ultimately might have protected thousands of people. And on September 1st, the CDC released for publication the order called Temporary Halt in Residential Evictions to Prevent the Further Spread of COVID-19. And here is the language of that order. Whenever the director of the CDC determines that the measures taken by health authorities of any state or possession are insufficient to prevent the spread of any of the communicable diseases to any other state or possession, he/she may take such measures to prevent the such spread of the disease as he/she deems reasonably necessary, including inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, and destruction of animals or articles believed to be sources of infection. Now, that doesn't actually say anything about evictions, does it? Well, the order continued. Eviction moratoria, that's the plural of moratorium, facilitates self-isolation by people who become ill or who are at risk for severe illness from COVID-19 due to an underlying medical condition. They also allow state and local authorities to more easily implement stay-at-home and social distancing directives to mitigate the community spread. Under this order, a landlord, owner of a residential property, or other persons with a legal right to pursue eviction or possessory action shall not evict any covered person from any residential property in any jurisdiction to which this order applies during the effective period, which is through December 31st. Then it says, this order does not relieve any individual of any obligation to pay rent, make a housing payment, or comply with any other obligation that the individual may have under a tenancy, lease, or similar contract. Nothing in this order precludes the charging or collecting of fees, penalties, or interest as a result of the failure to pay rent. So, under the heading that Linda wrote here, not so fast. Here's the fine print. Tenants will be required to pay all of the rent due per the terms of their lease in January, an impossible task for many households who would benefit from the order. Landlords, meanwhile, could be hit with a steep drop in income during the no eviction period and be forced to sell their properties or take on massive debt to weather the storm. Several Democratic lawmakers praised the Trump administration for the ban, but warned it could only make the crisis worse without rental assistance aid for tenants and landlords. And we'll get to the latest negotiations, or at least the angling in Washington here in a moment. But speaking of eviction, Yasha Levine has been a frequent guest on this program. He wrote Surveillance Valley, and he publishes a newsletter on a regular basis. And he announced over the weekend that despite paying rent on time, despite being clearly protected by existing tenant law, despite the pandemic and all the various eviction moratoria that are supposed to be in place at the federal, state, and local levels, he and his wife have received an eviction notice that is effective tomorrow. And he is not cited a reason as to why he is being evicted. He writes, so we're talking to an attorney about what our next steps are. It's almost certain we'll have to go through the courts. The landlord's going to officially file for eviction at some point very soon. We'll have to fight for our rights. The good thing is that the city, Los Angeles, their strong rent control law is on our side, but who knows how it'll actually play out. Eviction courts have just opened up in Los Angeles and California. Fighting a case during a pandemic with millions of people out of work and behind on rent, one thing's for sure, it's going to cost us money, money that we don't have. And he cites a CNN report where a reporter and cameraman followed a local cop in Houston who was making the rounds to issue eviction notices and boot people. The cop says he feels bad about forcing families out on the street, but hey, he's just following orders. Meanwhile, a mover hired to throw an old lady out of her apartment weeps all the way through his job. He doesn't want to do it, but he has no choice. He has to feed his family and pay his rent or face a similar plight. Well, we have the first confirmed death attributed to spreading of the coronavirus during the motorcycle rally in Sturgis, South Dakota. I guess the town is Deadwood. It's the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. The unidentified man from Minnesota was in his 60s and had underlying health conditions. And it raises the question about all of the protesters who hit the streets to fight for police reform, to protest the death of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, that there has been no measurable outbreak from those congregations. Now, some people wore masks, but not everybody did. Not that that is the only way to protect yourself, or that it always does protect oneself. But I tie that to this new report from the Color of Coronavirus Project, that total number of deaths and per capita death rates have increased dramatically in August for black and brown Americans. The latest figures show that in the 2 weeks from the 4th to 18th of August, the death rate of African Americans went from 80 per 100,000 to 88. The white population suffered half of that increase. And for Latino Americans, the increase was even more stark, from 46 to 54 per 100,000. And get this. The chief executives of 9 drug companies working on a vaccine for the coronavirus, they signed a public letter promising not to seek regulatory approval before safety and efficacy of their experimental vaccines have been established in Phase 3 clinical trials. Now, this is remarkable because many of these companies have already received contracts or cash from the federal government to participate in what Trump calls Operation Warp Speed. But they are standing up for our concerns? Forgive me if I'm just a little skeptical of these greedy bastards. But I think they know that at the fundamental level, that if consumers believe, and average Americans, that a vaccine has been put out to make Trump look good, to help him get reelected, and it ends up either being ineffective or the side effects are harmful or actually kill people, that it could destroy their industry. So the executives who signed on are from AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Moderna, Novavax, Pfizer, BioNTech, Sanofi, and GlaxoSmithKline. How about that? So I mentioned Mitch McConnell is back in Washington. The Senate is going into session today. The House does not go back to business until next week. But Mitch is signaling that he is going to try to cherry pick certain aspects of the Democratic House package of relief. And fundamentally, he is leaving out any aid to state and local government. We're on our own as far as Mitch is concerned. And so he's dangling the $300 or $400 a week of federal boost to unemployment insurance, child care, the post office, schools, but not a dime for state and local government. And that is so short-sighted because we will pay the price in just a few months. So the bookshelves are sagging. Michael Cohen's new tell-all book, Disloyal, is on sale today. He calls Trump a cult leader who should resign. The book includes claims about Trump's racism, hatred of Obama, admiration for Putin, his business interests in Russia, the relationship with the National Enquirer, his brutal treatment of women, and Cohen's role in the payoff schemes for Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal that landed him in federal prison. And as I've long argued, the Democrats should have included that in impeachment because Trump is just as guilty as Cohen. But they didn't press that button. Another insider book that is being published next week is by Josh Powell, who was the number two or top internal executive at the National Rifle Association. He was fired back in January, gave him time to write his book, which talks about the graft, corruption, and lack of management skills of Wayne LaPierre, the president of the NRA. And Peter Strzok, the former top FBI official who managed both the Hillary Clinton email investigation and the Trump-Russia investigation. His new book, Compromised, is coming out today, and he defends himself. I don't know how he explains his affair with FBI lawyer Lisa Page and their text messages, which just were stupid. And it's as if they felt that the surveillance systems that they could access to spy on us wouldn't capture their own communications. And Strzok, of course, defends the FBI, except the way that James Comey went public both in June and in October in ways that harmed Hillary Clinton related to the ongoing email investigations. And one of the things that I don't see covered in the New York Times report on Peter Strzok's book is anything about the FISA court. But there has been some action there, two cases of note. So the top surveillance court has found that the FBI committed widespread violations of rules intended to protect Americans' privacy when analysts search through the emails that are gathered without a warrant. And while the FISA court criticized the FBI, including for one investigation where they accessed files on 16,000 people, even though only about 7 of those 16,000 had any reasonable ties to the investigation. So just with what I just told you, you would suspect that the angry top judge at the FISA court, James Boasberg, would shut down FBI access to these programs. Nah. He renewed them for another year. And meanwhile, here in San Francisco, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the NSA's collection of Americans' domestic phone call records was unconstitutional. And did they shut it down and say this can never happen again? No. They upheld the convictions of the men whose rights were violated by the phone records collection program that the court found unconstitutional. Just totally bizarre. And finally today, about Jamal Khashoggi. He's described as an American journalist. He wasn't. He was a columnist, an opinion writer, who was picked up by the Washington Post. And late in his life, he was critical of the royal regime in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. But before that, he'd been a major apologist for it. At any rate, a court ordered that 5 of the 7 people who assassinated him are sentenced to 20 years in prison. Another individual got a 10-year sentence, and 2 others were ordered to serve 7 years in prison. And this lousy report from the Associated Press doesn't name a single one of those Saudis. So we know that it was low-level members of the assassination squad, not the head of, the equivalent of the CIA, who really was the point man in organizing the death and dismemberment of Khashoggi at the consulate of Saudi Arabia in Istanbul just about 2 years ago. Thanks for listening all the way through to today's News and Comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.